So, like I said at the beginning, we do have a speaker, and it's fallen on me to introduce them tonight. And quite interesting. I've learned more about this gentleman in the last 10 minutes before the meeting than I knew before. and I'm delighted to say that our paths have probably crossed. We share a lot of it, kind of probably share a lot of experiences, and a number of individuals that we've both known over the years in recovery. He's been around a while. He's going to share his experience, strength, and hope with us for the next 40, 45 minutes. His journey to, through, or into and through Narcotics Anonymous, whatever he feels comfortable with. He's been around a while. I'll leave him to share that with you if he chooses. And with that, Maurice, the floor is yours, my friend. Please jump in and share with us. And welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. I'm Morris. I'm an addict.
Hello, Maurice.
Hi,
I'm
Morris.
Morris.
Welcome.
Hi, Morris.
Welcome to the meeting.
And thanks for having me. As I say, it's nice to be here. It's nice to be asked. And we have a wonderful fellowship. But I'd like to talk, and I was thinking about what to say. And I thought the theme, my theme would be, I like a theme, then I can stick with it. If I go off base, I can come back to it. I suppose attitude is the theme for me this evening. And when I first came into NA, I was quite young. I was 19, and I was working and living in a community center. I was like a social worker, I suppose. I got into that area early, but I was still using, you know. And in this kind of drop-in center, I was the tree in the forest I spoke about, you know. I was so messed up that I was helping other people that were just as messed up as me, so I could fit in. And I didn't really see, the only thing that was going right for me at the time, in fairness, was using drugs. I kind of figured that that was going right. Everything else that life threw at me was making everything, you know, go wrong for me. But you know, my only saving grace was that I was using. I could depend on the drugs. And when I started using, I was at a very tender age. I was about 8. And I accidentally, well, I won't say accident because there's no such thing really. It's just a set of circumstances. I could nearly define my life as what it wasn't than what it was. And I grew up in a very difficult family, insofar as my parents were very poor themselves growing up. And so they, well, my mother was, but my father was a little bit over, better up the food chain. He had a steady job that he kept throughout his career, and they were kind of up and coming, but they came from a sort of a poverty mindset, especially my mother. And there wasn't much love going around. There wasn't much, you know, it just wasn't there. There was five of us, five siblings, and we were fighting for the only love that was available. And my mother favored my sisters, and so my mother tended to lavish hobbies and interests to them. And my sister was going through a phase of weaving baskets. That was her latest phase. I was about 8, and the phase lasted about a week, and so all the gear that was for the weaving baskets was put out in what we would call the shed or the outhouse. You would probably understand it to people. We used to call it the coal house, although they stopped putting coal in the shed years before, but it was still known as the coal house. And for most of my childhood, for one reason or another, maybe I thought, I remember thinking when I was 6 or 7, my parents had told me I was going to go to hell. Ah, you're going to go to hell, Morris. And I figured I'm going to go to hell, so what? I might as well enjoy the journey. So I was always up to development. I was always up to, like, robbing and stealing. I wasn't really, it was too young to be robbing, but I was kind of pushing the envelope out as far as I could go, and I was always in trouble with my mother. So her solution was to put me out in the coal house. I spent a lot of my childhood in the coal house. And with that phase my sister was in, the wee baskets ended up in the coal house with me. And I got to looking at that one day, and I saw those tiny little holes in the weave. I broke a bit off, lit a match and smoked it. Now, I didn't know it at the time, and for many years after that, but that what I was smoking was hemp, which was a derivative of what we might know as hash now, kind of a European thing. Cannabis is more for the United States, but in Europe we didn't really have that. We had more hashish. And but I didn't know anything about hashish. I just knew that when I smoked this weaved basket, life became a lot more durable. I didn't care then. In fact, I would break a window to get out into the coal house so I could smoke another bit. I used to hide the matches, and that weaved basket lasted me about 3 years. And I was high in as much as it became acceptable. So my initial idea of a drug or a chemical was something that made life easier for me. It wasn't that my life was easy, far from it, but I made the connection in my mind very early on that, if you get a little bit excess alcohol, or if you get a little bit extra, life will be easier. So I learned that lesson. That was my lesson. There ended the lesson. But that's where I started on my journey. And although I was about 8 at the time, and my sister went through piano and violin and all sorts of musical tastes that lasted a similar amount of time. Like when I was in my teens, we had all these musical instruments around the house that no one knew how to play. That was the thing. That was the thing there. And it was a very unhappy period of my life, but I didn't know any better. And as kids, you do the very best you can, and then you do your best to try and make the best of what you had. And that was where I started on my journey. Now, as I got older, I got into robbing and stealing, and I got into a lot of people were into alcohol because it was more freely available. I never really liked it, to be honest, which I never really, there's too much work to do, too much socializing to get to the point where it didn't matter and I didn't need to socialize anymore. So it never really held much interest for me. So if I got more money, I could get into, and I was going to school then, so there was a lot of robbing rather than our creative ways of generating monies, to get what I wanted. But it was more part time as I became to 14. I left school at 14 and started work, and then it was all about just getting enough to get by, or getting a little bit more and selling it and getting by. So the duality of using appealed to me as well, that I could live a dual sort of lifestyle, one that was public and one that was more private. It still had the end result. It wasn't that I didn't like drugs. I loved taking drugs. I loved it. I didn't like the consequences of the drug taking. So I didn't certainly look forward to giving them up. So when I got to this drop-in center, I would be helping a lot of people, but I think I did help, but it was conditional love. Like I used to say to my son when he was around 10 or 11, I'd say to him, if you want unconditional love, go to Mass. Go to a church, go to Mass. But if you want conditional love to me, you've got to, it's give and take. You know what I mean? It's not a given, because it definitely wasn't for me, and I didn't know how to do it for him. And regarding him and my relationship with him, I learned more about. So I worked. I just. What do I do with Narcotics Anonymous? I wanted to figure out what Narcotics Anonymous were doing, because I had drugs stashed all over that drop-in center. So I figured they had a meeting and decided, let's get Morris's stash. I really didn't believe that they were just sitting down getting well. So I entered the meeting. I started going to the meeting to find out what they were doing, not really thinking that I needed recovery and not really believing that they were addicts, because I knew them as addicts. A lot of the people came there initially. I'm talking about September 1983. That's when I started coming to meetings. And I just knew that I had seen them on the streets. I'd seen them strung out. So I couldn't believe that they weren't strung out for starters. And I didn't believe that they were staying together to stay clean. I figured that's what it said on the tin, but I didn't really believe it. But it was true. That was the first thing. And I kept coming back because I still didn't believe it, But then I realized, you know what, I'm going to have to get rid of all my stashes, because they were all over the house. So with another member, we went through the house under plants, behind the citron in the toilet, under the bath, under the floorboards, outside, under each plant in the garden. I had stashes everywhere, because I was a binge addict. I keep going every day using small amounts, but every weekend or whatever, I binge. Things got really hard, or circumstances got hard. I'd use more. I didn't see it as problems so much as that was normal for me. But when I started going to a few meetings, I realized, you know what, I'm going to have to get rid of this stash. So we filled a bag and a half, a refuge bag and a half, 1.5 bags, and we got rid of all those drugs. And then I got real. And then for a period of time, I think 6 months, 8 months, I think, it took me going to meetings before I got a day clean. I mean, I was cutting back and cutting down, but it took me 8 months to get a day. And by then, I saw this new life in NA more as a death than a new life. I just felt, what the fuck could I be without drugs? It defined me in every aspect. My life was messed up, but drugs were my only friend. So the idea of letting go my only friend wasn't that appealing to me at the time. I was quite down about it. I was quite, what's the point to living? Everybody else was like, oh, this is a great fellowship. And I'd be looking at them like saying, what are they on? Like, this is fucking not easy, And I struggled within myself. I then took myself from there. I went to live on the Aran Islands, which is off the coast of Galway, on the west side of Galway. Galway is my hometown where I'm from. But the Aran Islands was, I thought as an addict, well, there's no one out there. There's 1,000 people living on that island. They must be really spiritual. So I figured I'd go out there. That would be the place for me to kind of clean up and to get clean. There wasn't anything like a treatment centers or anything like that then. There was just, I just had an idea. And when I went out there, I was shocked to realize that anyone that could walk drank, and anyone who couldn't get to a pub, there was a local district nurse that I used to work with who came out and drugged them to the hilt with all sorts of, whether it be antidepressants or whether it be antipsychotic drugs, or they were all like, I mean, trying to get away from what I was doing. I was now working with a district nurse, but I managed to stay clean. I managed to keep clean for a year on that island. And it wasn't easy because I came from the city, and that was an agricultural place, you know what I mean? And because it was an island on a rock off the coast of Galway, it didn't have soil, for example. You'd have the topsoil, and then it would be limestone rock. So in order to make a garden, you had to build a garden. So you'd cut the topsoil and make the only earth that's there. And then you'd build up a working relationship with a donkey, go down to the shore, get half a ton of seaweed, convince them to come back and dump it on top of the soil. And slowly, surely, you could build a garden. I found that fascinating. I learned to grow all sorts of vegetables, potatoes, and everything on land that was solid rock underneath, and kept me clean. I got involved with the farmers, I got involved with the fishermen, and I stayed clean. And then I moved to Dublin, which is complete opposite now, going from very few people to loads of people, but not many meetings. We had about 8 meetings at the time in 1984, 1985, and so I moved to Dublin. And but there was more fellowship there. I felt that I really needed meetings, and it came good. I got involved in the area and the region of Ireland. We had our first regional meeting in 85, and I was involved in that. And I got involved in a relationship then with a girl that I really thought I loved at the time, but maybe not, but I didn't know any better. So she had a small problem with alcohol, and I ended up thinking, well, I have a 12-step program. I can help her. I can fix her, because through my life I've been a fixer. And it didn't work out that way, and I ended up back using in November 1988. I had got approximately 4.5 years clean and went back. And when I was clean, I lived a very responsible life. I became someone you could depend on. I became a pillar of the community. I became a person I never knew, really, because that's the person that wasn't me before that. I became this person. But once I went back using, soon as I went back using, I was irresponsible. I was not a person to hang around with. I remember my girlfriend at the time, before I went out, said, "Oh, you're not an addict, Morris. I've met a lot of addicts, and you're not one." And that was music to my ears. Oh, jeez, that's what I mean. Maybe I don't need this shit, this fellowship anymore. And of course, I used. And a week later, she said, "You're the fucking worst addict I've ever come across. What the hell are you doing with me?" And at that stage, it didn't matter, because I got back to doing what I was used to doing. I got back. I was on the edge again. I was kind of outside looking in, and I just went free for all for a complete relapse. Because at the end of 4.5 months, I was worse than I ever was, and I was taking stuff I never even considered to be on the market before I relapsed. But I lasted about 4.5 months, so I got clean again on the 23rd of March 1989. And I've been clean since, haven't you since? But as soon as I came in, I started working the steps. And that was the other thing I didn't do when I came in, and I thought it was a good idea that you guys got together and got clean and got well, because man, you were fucked. But me, I didn't see it that way. I didn't make the connection between me and my recovery and the fellowship and how the fellowship could help me. I could see you needed help, all right, but I couldn't see me in it, you know. I couldn't see me in the steps. I didn't feel, in truth, I realized after a few years, it was, I didn't feel worthy of them. But all those feelings went aside, and when I came back in, I got straight into the steps. I got myself a sponsor, and I had a sponsor, but I talked to him again, and he kept me on. And I really went for the program then. I didn't waste time. I didn't waste any time. I just got straight into it. And I owned the steps. I owned my life. I started to work those 12 steps really fervently, and went through them the first time, took some break, then went through the traditions. I remember doing the traditions and 1991, and nobody was doing the traditions or reading them or anything, but I kind of figured I needed to know how to get on with people, because I tended to be either very cynical with you or take things far too seriously. And my sponsor used to tell me in early recovery, he said, "Morris, you're going to have to try and take having fun more seriously." Because I was too serious all the time. Now, I had no idea what the man was talking about. I thought the man was on drugs. Do you know? What does he mean? What's a joke? Who jokes? Who has time for jokes? You know, like I was totally not the way I am now. I'm quite humorous now in the way I even see the world. I'm quirky. I'm a writer, I'm a novelist, so I'm in the middle of my second novel. I retired from my work 2 years ago last week, and now I don't see myself as retired anymore. I just see myself as a novelist, you know. So but back then it was a struggle. So it was like the first few years. Like I would have just finished the steps and the traditions. I kept doing service again, but not as much as I used to do. I used to do, excuse me. I get these cramps. It's not too bad now, sorry. I did two service positions. I used to do six or seven. I was running the joint at that stage, but I cut back. And if I was doing service for a year, I'd take a year off before I got into service again. I'm pretty much like that now, you know. I could see myself as having a shelf life in service for a couple of years, and I'd be very enthusiastic. But after 2 or 3 years, I was psychotic, and you were better off away from me. I hadn't really anything to contribute, and I was running on empty. But I had to do that a few times to realize what was going on. So, when I was about now, I was 11 years clean. I decided I would go to Mexico, just try something different. So I ended up being a teacher of English as a foreign language, and I went to Mexico, and I have just a few stories there. I started going out with a Mexican woman at the time, and one day it's very, the NA was like, if I thought it was bad in Ireland in the early 80s, it was pretty bad in Mexico in the noughties. So I went there in December 2000, and there were four meetings that I could find in the Republic of Mexico, you know, the Mexican Republic. And they were like, where I was in Sinaloa. So if I traveled east to Venacruz, I'd be on a bus for 13 hours to get to that meeting. If I traveled west, I'd have to go to La Paz, which was a ferry of 14 hours to get to that meeting. If I went south, I went to Guadalajara, which was a 22-hour bus journey, to go to that meeting. And then I used to travel north. I'd get a plane to Los Angeles. I'd get in, I'd be there for 8 or 9 days, and I'd get three or four meetings a day for 8 or 9 days, and then go home high on NA and recovery and try and hold out for another few months before I had to travel up again. So it was very different. But when I traveled up there once into LA, it was my 10-year clean time. And I went to a meeting in Burbank, California. And I was at the meeting. I arrived early. I'm an early bird. I arrived early. And there was a guy there. He was mopping the floor, a black African man mopping the floor. And I said, well, that's nice. And he didn't speak. He just did the work, you know. And I got a seat, sat down. Of course, I was on stilts because I had 10 years. Like, I was dying to tell someone I had 10 years. I was over the moon. And he put out the chairs, and then I helped him put out the chairs. Other people came, and then he stayed for the meeting. I said, God, this is very progressive. I was thinking, Jesus, he's so progressive. He was in overalls, and he sat for the meeting, and the meeting happened. Then I got my applause and in LA at the time, if you got 10 years, they give you a toy of a dinosaur, you know. So I got my toy dinosaur, and I was buzzing. And after the meeting, I asked another member, who is this guy? Who is he? Is he a janitor? I thought he was a janitor. I genuinely, God, I was in my head a lot. And who is this guy? He said, oh, he said, that's Bob B, Bob Barrett. He's one of the founding members of NA. He's like 44 years clean or something like that. Oh my I felt so much like, oh my God. I felt like trash. Of course, he didn't know. I thought he was a janitor, but I was mortified. I was mortified. And then I realized that everyone in LA and around had massive amount of clean time. So my mere 10 years was, you know, nothing, you know. And but it's just that my attitude was still kind of not where it needed to be. It was like when I got into too much service, I kind of got, well, everyone should be doing service. Why aren't you doing service? Kind of attitude towards it. And then that made me in conflict with people who weren't, for one reason or another, doing service. And my attitude was always a little bit off the charts, you know, and it reminded me that I needed to come home. This fellowship is about coming home to myself, but in order to recover, I needed to discover these different traits and attitudes within myself, because then I couldn't recover without them. So that was one I went back to. That's why I met him again at the World Convention in 2009 in Barcelona. And at that stage, Bob had Alzheimer's. He didn't know anyone from anyone. And I looked at him and sat with him. His eyes were vacant, and he passed soon after. But he was a hero of mine, you know. This man, if it wasn't for this man, I wouldn't be alive today. I really just, you know, those that go before us, I really have the most respect for. And a few years, now, another thing about me is that I suffer from epilepsy. Now, I don't get them anymore, but at the time, I got my last seizure in 2007. And when I came in 1989, I'd go to meetings. I'd get on a bus, and I'd have to take an hour bus into town and then another hour bus to the meeting I was going to. So it usually was 2 hours away from me. The problem, though, was I'd get an epileptic seizure on the bus and I'd end up in some hospital and I wouldn't know where I was or how to get home again. So I'd made deals with the bus drivers that if in the event I got one of these, that they leave me the fuck alone so I could get to my meeting. And that most of them did, in fairness. But I would get a certain aura or feeling about having a seizure before I got it. They call it an aura. You just start to feel dizzy. And I was in Mexico once in a couple of years later, and I was working as a teacher in central Mexico in a place called Morelia. And I was trying to I was off and I was just kind of sweeping up and I started to feel the feelings of a seizure, sort of dizziness and sweatiness. And so I said, I'll go out the front door to get a bit of air. I went out the front door, got a bit of air, and I just felt everything was moving around. I had vertigo. And so then I went in to see my girlfriend, became my wife. My Mexican girlfriend became my wife. And then I needed to tell her that I'd probably get a seizure, I was terrified. Those auras used to freak me out. And so I went in through the house and right into the bedroom, and my wife was holding on to the bed, like, holding on to bars. She said, hold me, it's an earthquake. And I said, oh, this is great. It's great. It's only an earthquake. It wasn't me, it was an earthquake. It's like I was so self-centered that this was going to happen to me that I didn't realize that I was in the middle of an earthquake. The world shook, the trees were rocking back and forth, the walls were moving in, and I didn't. Oh, I was so relieved. I said, oh, it's only a fucking earthquake. And she said, what do you mean? She said, she was holding on for dear. What do you mean? Hold me. Like, my attitude was gone again, It was like, oh my God. But it was such, oh my God, because I never, ever was in an earthquake before. And I just thought that was a lot of humor for me, but it actually 700 people died that day in that earthquake in central Mexico. And I joke about it now, but actually I'd never been able to describe what it felt like to be getting an epileptic seizure till I was in that earthquake, because that's exactly what it like. The walls move, everything moves. No matter where I go, I feel everything's going to fall down on top of me. And I got my last one of them in 2007, in March 2007. And I do feel grateful. I feel my life took on a completely different turn when that happened, because up to then, every day, even for every seizure I got, there'd be 100 or 200 times that I'd be getting panic attacks about a possible one that never came. So it had an awful effect on me, especially in early recovery. I used to be called, as a nickname, Morris the Lights then, because fluorescent lights would send me off. So if someone, if the meeting was getting dark and somebody turned on the lights, boom, I'd hit the floor and I wouldn't know why. But it was the light that runs between those fluorescent lights would start me. And or if someone flashed a camera, I'd have another, and I never knew quite for sure that I'd ever reach my destination. So these were the things that had to change. These were the issues that I had to deal with in recovery as I made my way to the point of getting to know Morris. And each time that I do the steps, the 12 steps with my sponsor, I was able to find, and no, it was almost like ironing a shirt. I'd get another crease I'd understand, oh yeah, that's a defect or that's something I need to work on. And that's something that will help me now if I work on this. And I've got to learn about Morris because my eyes are focused externally, and that's the way I was coming in. When I was using, I was always thinking about who would help me use more. Who could I ask? Who should I avoid? Who have I messed around? I can't go near them now. So I was constantly calculating circumstances that were outside myself. Whereas this program and fellowship is helping me focus inside as to what's going on with me right now. What can I do about it? Are there any steps that I can practice today if I'm uneasy to get to at least understand why that is the case and then find remedies for that? So the attitude took a while to go in various disguises. Now, for example, in about 3 years ago, or I beg your pardon, 4 years ago, my marriage ended. We were just going in two different directions. That's probably one of the most painful parts. Of my, we're still separated today. We're good friends, but separated. And but it's still a very painful part of my life because I had to move in one direction and allow the other person go in another. And I practice a program in that. I watched my father die. He died quite old. But I was able to be with him rather than kind of hold on to him. He got a tumor in his brain and it was inoperable, and but he was always a very stern man in his life. But because of this tumor, I would work with him, and he was in the care home. I went into him one day, and he never say anything bad about anyone. He went in one day, and I asked, "How are you doing today, Dad?" "Oh," he says, "there was a nurse in there. Talking to him, and he said, I have a fine bunch of whores looking after me in here." And he didn't mean it, Anthony. It's just that he had no filter in the last 8 months of his life. Just had no filter. He didn't, whatever came into his head, he said. And he didn't mean it. And they didn't take offense. And I didn't take offense. And I got to see a different side of him then. And I believe because of this program and the work that I do on me in here, I could be there for him and know that his time was coming to an end. I remember walking with him once and he said, "You know, I'm going home soon." And I said, "Yeah, I'm going to bring you home as soon as we leave here." "No," he said, "I don't mean that home." And I knew what he meant. So there were days when he was lucid enough to say those things to me, and rather than tell me, "No, don't be thinking like that, Dad, that's not right," and I just allow him to be himself the way others in here allowed me to be myself long enough to love myself. I don't need them to love me anymore. I do love myself. I'm not perfect. I'm a work in progress. And I've learned in here that we can love each other back to life. And by serving, it's not a chore, it's not an attitude. If someone asks me to do something, I will genuinely do it. Not because I have to, but because we're family and we're a fellowship. And if we help pass this message to others, we enable ourselves to lose any attitude that we may have towards, I haven't time for that right now. I want to be busy doing other things. So I never say no to service. I never say no to the fellowship. Because what we have is something to love, it's something to treasure, and it's a gift. And the only way we can keep it is to give it away. It's very ironic, really. But that's the nature of what we have. And over time, like I'm 36 years and 3 months clean. I'm in my 37th year. And but that's a day at a time. That's working a program a day at a time. There's no kind of, I was at a meeting recently and I asked them, where will you be in 36 years' time? Do you know? I know we live a day at a time, but if I count the days, doesn't work. But if I live today in 36 years' time, I'll either be in Narcotics Anonymous or I will have passed on. And either way is okay because I've learned in here that no matter what happens, it's okay. And thanks for listening. I appreciate it.